The section that we are going to begin is devoted to digital communication. Before of entering into the details concerning protocols, communication techniques, buses, and hardware signals, it is necessary an introduction that depicts the general context into which these techniques are applied. The information that must be communicated are typically put in biunivocal correspondence with symbol sequences that in turn to be produced by a sender and received at the destination desk are represented by physical phenomenon called signals, since they indeed represent a function that brings a significant information. The correspondence between informations and symbol sequences is called codification. Codification's rules are a priori arbitrary, and this allow to have significant quality factor that will be optimized. However, these rules must be carefully followed by sender and receiver, otherwise we lose completely the possibility of information exchanging. These rules, on the other hand, allow to have very cheap physical devices to be used for the signals and the shake, to generate with high speed sequences of symbols, and to obtain a very tolerant margin with respect to the noise that can be present on the line. Concerning the characteristics of the transmission media that allow signals propagation, we have to take into account simple cable, coaxial cable, and air. With the suitable devices, typically electronics, that allow to generate, amplify, convert, and so on, the transmitted signals. Typically, the transmitted bits are associated to suitable voltage ranges. Consider that these ranges can be different depending on the fact that the transmission is serial or parallel. We will see the corresponding ranges that are used in the two different techniques. But sometimes voltage signals can be also modulated to make them more robust with respect to the presence of the noise. These aspects will be explained in the next lessons. For now, let's consider that one of the most important factors in the communications is related to the frequency band that is compliant with the medium used for the transmission. Typical characteristics of a transmissive medium are the frequency band expressed in Hertz, typical values range from 100 kHz to 1000 MHz. On the frequency depends the maximum velocity of transmission. The attenuation expressed in dB per kilometer. Typical values are 0.4, 1.5, and this influences the maximum distance that can be covered without repeaters. The propagation velocity expressed in kilometer per second from 5000 typically to 150,000. The characteristic impedance expressed in ohm, maximum 1 kilo ohm, and the immunity to the noise. Typical transmissive medium for electric signals and distances greater than few meters are twisted pair with shielding mechanisms, coaxial cables, and air. It is important to notice that optical fibers become a typical and very interesting transmissive medium for several applications, but in many industrial applications the previous medium are still used and very popular, due also to the fact that at now optical fibers could be considered still expensive for industrial processes. Optical fibers are characterized by high immunity to the disturbances, galvanic insulation, and very high frequency band. Drawbacks are the costs, still high, and the installation that is not trivial, in particular considering a possible non-linearities in the wires that bring the optical fiber. And this requires high level skills and specific equipment. A final remark is about the difference between transmission velocity, that typically is measured in symbols per second, or also called baud rate, and the propagation velocity of the signal, that is measured in meter per second, and is lower, but not so much lower, than the velocity of the light in the vacuum, 300,000 km per second. As you have seen in the slide, we consider typical propagation velocities that at maximum are 150,000 km per second. Before we enter in the details about the binary information transmission technique, it is useful to make a very short overview about the problems that must be solved so as to perform in the correct way those transmissions. First of all, we can consider in what direction information must be sent, and typically we distinguish three possibilities called simplex, half duplex, and full duplex. Simplex is the transmission that corresponds to only one monodirectional channel and allow the transmission from a sender to one or more receivers. Half duplex instead corresponds to a bidirectional channel or two monodirectional channels with the orientation that is opposed, reciprocally opposed, and the communication will be performed with the mutual exclusion, so as every device can or transmit or receive, but not both at the same way. The half duplex approach is typical in local networks and is often used even when it is possible to exploit two channels that would allow the full duplex systems, since the strict alternation of transmission and reception simplifies very much the protocols of confirmation or repetition of wrong messages. The last policy that can be implemented is the so-called full duplex that requires the use of two channels, two distinct channels for the reception and the transmission that in this way can be performed simultaneously. Many serial interfaces, for example RS-232, are physically conceived in such a way. Also, often it is preferred to use them in the half-duplex way. Those informations that must be transmitted are generally structured in a hierarchical way. Therefore, we will have groups of bits, 7, 8 or 9, and the characters will be made of those bits. Notice that in many cases we consider characters in ASCII codification, but sometimes characters are made of bytes that can represent information with different codifications. Suitable sequences of characters made the so-called messages. The organization of characters in messages is not absolutely mandatory, but generally is suggested by communication protocol needs. For example, in a half-duplex connection, the end of a message provides to the partner the opportunity for answering, and in general, in the local and wide area networks, messages, often called packets, allow to have different concurrent communications. Moreover, there are needs for recognizing errors and correcting them related to the presence of messages that must be repeated and sized in length so as to establish if their repetition is convenient or limit the bandwidth of the communication in a not acceptable way. Due to the fact that symbols are transmitted sequentially, a suitable synchronization between the sender and the receiver is required, that is, an agreement on what time windows are devoted to the representation of what kind of symbols. Generally speaking, auxiliary signals are used so as their commutations will indicate those instants significant to the synchronization of the partners in the communication. In parallel communications, or in those communications that feature short distances, generally it is convenient to adopt one or more connections to transmit those auxiliary signals. On the other hand, in serial communications, or in general in those communications that are made between very far interlocutors, it is preferred to associate to the same signal both the task to convey informations significant and the relative temporization. In these cases, typically auxiliary signals are locally generated both by the sender and by the receiver so as to respect the necessary temporization. Notice that the hierarchical structure of the information, organized with bit, characters, and messages levels, requires a correspondent hierarchy in the synchronization structure that allows to recognize the instance into which bits are valid, but also those instances into which groups of bits constitute a character, and what sequences of characters made a message. Concerning the error prevention, we have to consider that a possible source for errors, that is wrong recognition of the symbols, is typically represented by disturbances that are electrical, physical, parasite phenomena that change the shape of the signals. Particularly important are, therefore, those techniques that reduce the presence of disturbances in the connection, protect the signals from those phenomena, and allow the choice of signals that are particularly robust in terms of voltage amplitude. About the recognition and the correction of the errors, we have to accept, in any case, a non-zero error rate. In fact, errors introduced by noise and every kind of disturbance can be limited, but not completely eliminated. With the error rate, usually we mean the relationship, the ratio, between those symbols that have been received as wrong and the total number of the transmitted symbols. Notice that, generally speaking, we can accept an error rate relatively high if that most of these errors are at least recognized, also not corrected. On the other hand, for at least some errors, it is necessary that together with their recognition, a certain degree of recovery of the correct original information is assured. Therefore, we will have three possible error rates. Those that are related to non-detected errors, those that are related to error recognized, but with the reaction of the relative information, and those that are related to errors recognized and reconstruction of the relative information. Notice that those techniques that are devoted to the recognition of the errors are typically based on the usage of redundant symbols, while the techniques that are devoted to the correction of the errors are based on the intrinsic redundancy of the message, that is, on the presence of self-corrector codes, or they are based on an approach on demand that corresponds to the repetition of those messages that have been recognized as wrong. A final and very important issue that must be considered in particular when we must deal with the communications among more than two partners, like in the typical networks, is made by the temporal and spatial coordination of the different communication phases, so as to avoid conflicts in the access to the transmission media, and so as information arrive to the destination point within a certain acceptable time and in the correct sequence. The management of the time sequences is made through suitable protocols, while the spatial management is made by suitable routing policies of the messages. Now, let's come to analyze in a more concrete way the main technical aspects of the most popular communication techniques with digital codification, the so-called parallel communications. In the short distance connection, with short distance we mean up to a few meters, when we need to perform a very fast communication, typically, the so-called parallel communications techniques are used. Parallel because groups of bits, typically bytes, 8 bits, or words, 16 bits, or extended words, 32 bits, are contemporaneously transmitted on a corresponding number of wires. In any case, however, bytes and words are in turn transmitted serially. That is, we could say in a more correct way that the transmissions are bit parallel and byte serial. Except the internal connection to the CPU that we are not considered in this part of the course, the most popular parallel connections are called IEEE 488 and Centronics, and will be briefly described in the following. Notice, however, the important difference between system buses and communication buses. The difference is mainly related to the addressing technique, because in the system buses, the master puts on suitable lines the address of the interlocutor, of the partner. Those lines will belong to the address bus. In the communication buses, the sender will insert into the data that are transmitted even the address of the destination point. In the parallel connection, the transfer synchronization, both in case of bytes, words, large words, it is made through suitable auxiliary signals that allow to perform an hand-shaking technique like the one that is shown in slide number 8. This technique allows to tune the velocity of the transmitter and of the receiver so as to avoid the loss of information and taking into account the tolerances on the different commutations times of the parallel bits. In the figure, we see that the transmitting unit will put the single datum on the parallel line and will raise up a suitable signal whose significance is data ready. The edge of that signal will be received by the receiving unit that will monitor continuously that line, and when the receiver unit understands that the data is ready, it will read the connection line, the content of the information line and will raise up the other auxiliary signal devoted to the hand shaking, that is the so-called data received signal. The transmitting unit will monitor continuously that line, and when it understands that the level is high, it will put lower the data ready line and will cancel the content it has previously written on the main connection line, preparing for the transmission of the next part of the message. The receiving unit will read the data ready line of the transmitting unit, and when it understands that the level of that line is low, it will put low its own level of the so-called received data line. One can argue why we don't use synchronous buses. In a synchronous bus, the clock signal is included in the control lines, better in those auxiliary lines that are sent together with the lines that provide the bits of the information exchange between a sender and a receiver. The use of a synchronous bus requires, however, a fixed protocol for the communication, that is a sequence of steps executed in a synchronous way at a certain clock cycle sequence. Let's make an example and let's consider the communication exchange between the CPU and its own memory. In the first clock cycle, read the command and the relative address of the location that must be accessed are sent on the bus by the CPU to the memory. After few cycles, for example, let's say 5 clock cycles, the memory will respond, providing the requested data on the bus. And finally, the CPU will read those data and will write them, for example, into a set of registers. And let's say that this happens in 3 clock cycles, and then the elaboration continues. We know that such a sequence of operations can be implemented with a finite state machine, in this case very small, that can be made through a very elementary digital logic components, providing a fast response, a small interfacing, so with a lot of benefits. However, such a kind of approach requires that all the devices must work at the same frequency. And this is not said because we made the example of the CPU interfaced with its own memory. But typically we have to consider networks into which many devices can communicate among them, and those devices typically are not carried out by the same farm, by the same company, so they have technical and physical different characteristics. Moreover, the buses must be kept physically very short to avoid the misalignment with respect to other devices. For example, imagine that a certain machine must communicate the same information to another couple of devices. The first one is at 100 meters from the communicating machine, and the second one is at 500 meters from the communicating machine. It is clear that the same information will arrive at two different instants of time to the two partners of the communicating machine, and this is a skew. This represents a misalignment with respect to the instance of time into which the two devices must receive and, of course, elaborate the information sent by the original one. These two drawbacks basically don't encourage the usage of synchronous buses, and this is the reason why we avoid to organize the communication in steps ruled by the clock cycle sequences, and we prefer to organize the communication in phases on the basis of the communications of the auxiliary signals that are used. One of the most popular parallel communication protocols was proposed at the beginning of 1975 by Hewlett-Packard to carry out a network between calculation systems and instrumentations made by different manufacturers. This communication protocol was called General Purpose Interface Bus and was recognized as a standard by the IEEE Institute with the codification 488. And successively, it was adopted by as a standard by the main manufacturers. It underwent to modifications, redefinitions, but preserving the original structure that allows to connect up to 15 devices on the same bus, featuring 16 lines, of which 8 are of data values, 3 are devoted to the handshake between the partners, and 5 are devoted to the interfacing management. Each device can play 3 possible roles, the so-called talker, listener, and controller, so it is possible to specify type and functions of the connected instrumentation in every phase of the communication. Signals are in TTL, transistor-transistor logic, low-level active, with open collector driving that allows to automatically adapt the communication velocity to the slowest of the devices that are involved in the communication. Typically, the transfer velocity of the bytes is set around 1 megabyte per second. The IEEE 488 parallel bus management envisions that a device can be programmed to be the system controller or the active controller. The difference is that the system controller is considered the general master of the communication, while the active controller is the device that during a normal working phase, working cycle, manages the communication without being the top of all the devices present in that moment into the network. Among the functions that the controllers can manage, we remember the interface clear, the remote enable, that are functions allowing a complete clear of the present communication, or to enable specific devices to listen or to transmit. Looking at slide 11, we can see the number of the lines that are involved into the management of the IEEE 488 standard bus. We see 8 bit data bus. I remember that in some configurations, some releases of the IEEE 488, even 16-bit data communications are possible. Then we have 5 lines called management bus. And finally, we have 3 lines devoted to the handshake. Several controllers can be present at the same time, but only one will be the active at now, the so-called in-charge controller. The system that manages the overall communication, the so-called system controller, will pass the control among active controllers on a token mechanism basis that is followed with regard to a specific configuration that is set at the beginning of the communication. A listener receives the data from the bus only when the present active controller enables it, and similarly, a talker device transmits only when the active controller enables it. It is possible also to perform a multicast transmission between a single talker device and a listener group. Let's give a better description to the lines devoted to the management of the communication. We said that we have 5 lines called attention, ATN, EOI and or identify, IFC, interface clear, REN, remote enable, and SRQ, service request. The first line, attention, is managed by the controller, the active controller, that indicates that an address or a control is present onto the bus. So this line says that the content of the data on the bus identify a particular device to which the controller is sending a particular information, for example, to enable it to transmit or to listen. The active controller disables it when the next phase of the communication should take place, that is, when the talker should transmit, and will activate again, I mean the line attention, to continue in the transmission management, for example, to assign to another device the role of a talker so as to perform another step of the overall communication. And or identify is a line that can be used in two ways. If it is enabled by the present talker device, this means that it has finished its own transmission, and therefore the control comes back to the system, to the active controller, to manage the next step of the communication. If instead is enabled by the active controller, it must be activated together with the ATN signal, the ATN lines, and it corresponds to a parallel pole to all the devices. We will see that we have two ways for an active controller or for the system controller to, let's say, understand if the devices needs particular services. The first is a polling phase into which all the devices at the same time will answer something about their needs, or the second alternative is the so-called serial poll, into which every device on a one-by-one basis will answer to the request of the controller, saying, clarifying its own eventually present needs. Interface clear is a general reset that is activated by the system controller, and it brings all the devices in a known initial state. So basically, it is activated when a problem, a consistent problem, is detected onto the line, just to flush every kind of interrupted communication and to restart the system again, for example. Remote enable is a line that is managed by the system controller or the active controller that allows the devices to work in remote control mode, disabling the local control from the front panel if present. This function must be understood considering that such a kind of protocol was especially at the beginning conceived to manage both the communication from a personal computer, from a computer, towards suitable devices, but also to manage the communication between, for example, the computer and an instrument like an oscilloscope. From this point of view, we understand, we know that an oscilloscope is can be managed locally by an operator that pushes some buttons, tunes the sweep of the signal, regulates how the signal must be represented onto the display, and sets the amplification gain of the signal acquired, and more and more and more. This particular function allows to do all these things from a remote location, that is, from the computer. And clearly, it is a very delicate point that must be managed only by the main controller into the system. Finally, we have a service request line that represents something similar to an interrupt, through which a device can ask to the controller a certain service, a certain action, and the controller will identify the emitting device through a serial poll that will allow the specific device to answer, so identifying itself as the responsible for the interrupt request, releasing the SRQ signal. In this way, the system controller, the general controller, understands who emitted the request, and a further protocol aiming at the satisfaction of the particular request of the device will be executed. In slide 13, the handshake signals are shown. As we have already said in the general presentation, we have three typical signals that are present even in this case: data valid, not ready for data, and not data accepted, together with the classic data I/O lines. All the signals are managed in TTL inverse logic. Coming to a better description of the significance of the signals, we can say that not ready for data is a value that is managed by one or more receivers in open collector mode, and if high means that the receivers are ready for receiving data. If instead is low, remember that is active low, it means that one or more of the receivers cannot manage the reception of data. data acquisition, in other words. In this way, we adapt the transmission to the slowest one of the receivers. Similarly, not data accepted is again managed in open collector mode and is low active, meaning that only when it is definitively low, receivers can accept a new data, can perform a new acquisition. Until the signal is high, this means that one or more of the receivers are doing the acquisition, and for the transmitter it is not possible to transmit a further set of data to perform a further transmission. Data valid, instead, is a signal managed by the transmitter, and it is active low again. When low, it means that data has been put in the DIO lines, so the receivers, if they can, are enabled, let's say, to perform the acquisition. Time diagram of the sequence of the data together with the handshake signals is shown in the upper right part of the slide. We see that the data valid signal is high if the transmitter, that could be a controller or a talker, wants to transmit, and when the datum has been put on the line, the data valid signal will be set low, so as to inform all the receivers that there is something that can be acquired on the line. Notice that if not ready for data and not data accepted are at the same time low, the data can be written. Only when not ready for data is high, data valid will be set low but by the sender, and clearly this has a correct logic, because to raise up not ready for data means that instead the receivers are ready for receiving the data, so the information can be given to them. Okay, you are ready, something is present for you on the bus. Every receiver typically keeps the not ready for data low to signal to be busy, so please don't transmit to me. When the last one will have completed the receiving phase, not data accepted will be set high to say all data have been accepted, so another transmission can be performed, and this information detected by transmitter will be, let's say, acknowledged by raising high the data valid signal. Finally, if when setting high the data valid line, the sender finds not data accepted and not ready for data together at the same time, I mean high, this is let's say a signal that an error happened. Moreover, if a device cannot perform correctly the handshake and releases the not data accepted or the not ready for data, this is another way to signify an error situation and to raise, let's say, an exception to the correct communication procedure. Consider that the error is managed by the operating system as a timeout error, typically. In slide 14, data valid, not ready for data, not data accepted, the signals are shown together with the data IO lines, following the same procedure as mentioned before. So they don't deserve, I think, any further comment, and I leave them to your personal deepening.